of the sciences. And I tried to show you last time, it was I think on Friday, that there had to be the three ages present in the construction of a university, of an institution of higher learning. Gentlemen, when you go to school, and you only go to school, and you call this even a class, you don't call it a real lecture, and you say this is school, then you always think that mankind is divided in two generations, the adult and the children, and you are somewhere in between. And you think that the older people teach the young. That is all right for the schools of a nation. And since we live in an era of blind nationalism, most people like you think that this is what a school is about. To teach the young something the old don't know. But that isn't the whole story of the institutions of higher learning, and we wouldn't have to bother about schools in the Western world if there hadn't been more to it than just schools, where children learn the three R's. Mothers and fathers can teach that just as well. Gentlemen, obviously what we call a system of education today always is open to the future, and it implies that the child must be exposed to certain processes which at the same time go on in grown-up society and which the parents or the children otherwise would not become acquainted with. That is, gentlemen, there are three generations present in institutions of higher education. Three generations. You remember we had the three as the priest, as the fighter, and as the artist, or as the elder, and the adult, and the child. Now, gentlemen, you live in a dialectic, in a dualistic, in a rational society. Everything to you is simple. That which isn't black is white, and that which isn't lust is pain. And you always think it's either or. Oh, gentlemen, if life was so simple. Mankind is much more complicated. It is consists of at least three generations present at any one moment. And that's what I tried to show you in the Ten Commandments of Education. And now we have trying to tell you, which you do not know, which you want to ignore, and for what reason education today is simply a racket in America, the seventh big racket, I don't know which the six others are. But with the press and television and advertising, it goes very well together. It's a racket. Because nobody knows which direction it has to take, it's just a habit. If you look around what this country spends on education, it is absolutely, you see, dogmatically bound that education is something wonderful. And then you come to these people in education, including you gentlemen, students, you say, we are all without any dogma, we are all undogmatic. Now there you have the first abstruseness of this country. You see, you're absolutely dogmatic that education is good. But then you come, I talk to any one of you and you say, oh, I have no dogma. I'm open-minded. But gentlemen, why then isn't education perhaps bad? Why is education good? Isn't it a strange dogma in which you all, to which you all belong? You don't belong to a church, but you belong to education. Churches are bad. They are narrow-minded. They are bigot. So many people among you say, but education is always good. But gentlemen, you can only be educated into a church. There's no other education. So if the churches are bad because they are bigger and dogmatic, then you are certainly in a strange process. You are in a headless process, an education without direction, without aim and purpose, just for the purpose of entertaining you for the first 25 years of your life and getting you off your parents' hands. And making your poor mother go to work so that she can you can spend all the money during your educational process. That's why so many mothers have to go into business, because their children have to get a higher education, including the girls, at Smith College. Is this a higher education they get there from you? But gentlemen, you don't even give it a thought. You are in the midst of the greatest corruption there is, has ever been in the world. A waste of decades of life on a process called education, which has no head, no direction, no purpose, no meaning, no values, no dogma, no faith, and this is all wonderful.
Gentlemen, higher education, or the institutes of higher learning, have escaped this tremendous corruption by making present in their processes what I tried to tell you in the definition of the university. The three facts of life, gentlemen, that there has to be unity in the necessary, there has to be liberty in the dubious, and there has to be charity in all. Remember, I bring back what I try to develop. But gentlemen, this is not pious phrasing. This means the presence of the child, the adult, the fighter, and the elder in every one of us. Because if you have to have charity, you have to act like a priest. If you have to have doubts in liberty for your doubts, you have to act as a fighter. And if you have to have faith and obedience and loyalty, you have to be like a child. Trusting and dogmatic, and believing in the dogma proposed to you by society. And once you begin to think through this great sentence of St. Augustine, gentlemen, that we live by unity in the necessary, by liberty in the dubious, and by charity in all, in both the dubious and the necessary, you begin to discover the secret of men's trinity. Today people laugh at the Trinity. You think, oh, God is my own idea. Very nice idea. God is a supreme being. Somebody here said in class after class to me, why isn't God just infinity? Because this asinine character of a student's brain, at least, God has escaped from in human tradition. God is not your idea. God is the power that makes me speak at this moment and that makes you listen. And that makes us understand each other. And that's infinity. Isn't it more personal than you and I? What are we? This piece of dirt, gentlemen. The only person there is God. You don't know what a person is except through him. You are not a person. I'm not a person. We are little apes without him. But you believe that you are a person. A personality, you have to say, of some successful executive who gets $20,000 a year. That you call a personality, but God is infinity. God is an idea. God is a concept. Good gentlemen. How can you have an institution of higher learning? How can the stream of the divine spirit go through the ages? How can Dartmouth College exist in 1770? It has nothing to mold you into some frame of reference, to some personal life, so that you are a little better than you leave Dartmouth and you came here. Now, what is this better, gentlemen? What is this higher? What is this more in education? Certainly is nothing you contribute. You receive it here. If you brought it here, you wouldn't have to come here to have it. But the megalomania of your generation is total, I mean. You really think that you are human beings per se. Without your fathers, without the spirit of the Christian era, without any background, and without the institutions which mold you, gentlemen. You go to school and say, what do you have to offer? Instead of asking, would you be kind enough to allow me to enter and to become a human being? Well, what I'm trying to say is, gentlemen, the institutions of higher learning can be lost in every civilization. And I told you that at this moment, this country has no institutions of higher learning. It has just big freight yards of knowledge. But knowledge is not education. Because knowledge cannot decide what is necessary, what is dubious, and what is the charity between Mr. Oppenheimer and Mr. McCarthy. And we have to know this, gentlemen. And it has to be learned in every hour of life. Again, we never know it as knowledge goes, you see. Knowledge you can conserve in the Encyclopedia Britannica. But the relation of the three generations of your mentality, of the child in you, of the priest in you, and of the fighter in you, you have to rediscover with every breath of life every morning. because it is different every day. The solution of the problem which besets a modern society, gentlemen, or which besets society since the first days of Adam, it presents itself in a different manner every day. That which is dubious, you see, differs every day. It didn't seem dubious 50 years ago that science should be public. At this moment, it's a deep secret. As you know, the scientists are all locked up behind a lock and key because the United States thinks they couldn't survive if the science would be publicized. Now, isn't that strange that these things can change from day to day? But this is with everything, gentlemen. You have been allowed to go into schools, gentlemen, away from home under the assumption that morality and religion and the spirit is taught you at home, and that we have to brush up on your languages and on your technical knowledge, on your mathematics and physics. Now, what has happened in the last 50 years, gentlemen? The homes have ceased to function. That is, everything you so far, down to 1900, received at home. The English language, the poetry, the admiration for Shakespeare, the power to speak and to write poetry, the interest in making love in a poetical and imaginative way, the power to inherit enough to lead your own life and your own economy, to learn a real special profession so well, you see, that you could build up an independent farm or an independent business. All this has vanished on the surface of the earth. You live in apartments, homes, in houses, in cities. You never see your parents work. They go elsewhere where they do the typing or the telephoning. You never see how they are cheated or do cheat. So you don't know what life is all about. You go to high schools. You see cops. And that's the most of an adult you can ever come to know. Your teachers aren't allowed to act like adults. They have to be like children, like as you are. So you never meet adult people in life for the first 20 years of your life. In action. You don't. And now we have this college system, gentlemen, which was invented in order to add to your experience of a sound and full home and community life, you see, and to add to you a little of the graces and the muses and the spices of life, history and classical civilization. Now what shall we do, gentlemen? We have learned A from B. You think that motherly love is an obsession, is a psychoanalytical complex. You haven't learned to conquer jealousy. You haven't conquered anything. You don't know what friendship is. You're only chummy with 200 boys at school lunch. That you call friendship. You never have a friend. Now, all the whole college, look even at Mr. Hovey's poetry, was still based on the assumption that all the better powers of our life, of your childhood, would be learned elsewhere, and that the education institution of learning would just add, as I said, some instruction, some languages, some facts. As you well know, today a boy goes to college to learn how to live. And generally he doesn't, but at least he tries. Therefore, our whole curriculum has changed. We don't teach you Latin and Greek. Do you think that's accidental? It makes no sense to teach you Latin and Greek, you see, because you don't know English. You know basic English, that is no English. You can tell a poem, but can you write a poem? And so, gentlemen, only to show you that higher education is the power to discover what is lacking in the equilibrium of education at any one moment. At this moment, you are a student of darkness if you help us to discover the next curriculum. If you understand that you are the guinea pigs because you receive an inadequate education for the changes of the times, you see, because everything is different. Because the homes no longer furnish this college with educated children. Half of the children come from broken up families and from psychoanalyzed families, that is, from broken up, from destroyed, cauterized, remnants of the old tradition. How many of you come from an integrated church life? Have to go to Sunday school, but do your parents go too? the houses today are not just divorced between husband and wife. Much worse is the fact that the parents go one way and the children are sent to Sunday school the other way. Every child knows that, where if the parents have one religion and ask the child to have the opposite religion. This is one of the cancers of our society, you see. That the parents and the children are expected to have two different religions. So that, of course, there is no religion, that's a joke. It's diabolical. Now, with all this diabolical background, you come here to Dartmouth and you wish now to receive an educated gentleman. If there was just a school system, we would go on, be able to go on and teach the 3 hours. Because there would be just adults and gentlemen. The gentleman, the priest, the elder. You remember what we said of Newman and Plato and John Quincy Adams? Is the man who at any one moment has to decide between the fighter and the child, between the adult and the child. He has to say who's right and who's wrong and in what respect. And that is very revolutionary, gentlemen. The institutions of higher learning, gentlemen, abolish the mere sequence of time from old to new. No responsible educator can say something is good because it is new. And he cannot say something is good because it is old. He cannot say that the class of 54 thinks in this manner. Therefore, that's what it is. And the class of 30 thinks in this manner. So we have to acquiesce and satisfy the alumni, otherwise we don't get the alumni fund. Gentlemen, neither the alumni fund nor your interest and satisfaction is any reason for determining the direction of education. But you think that is. You really think that the fact that you elect my course is a reason for my giving the course in such a way that more will elect the course. Gentlemen, I probably should give a course in such a way that less and fewer pupils, students get the course, take the course. That wouldn't be in any way proof that it's a poor course. Isn't that clear? If that's the right, it's a better course, which it is difficult for you to find access to and to approve of. There's no reason why I should have 200 students in this course. Perhaps I only should have 5. There you see the real dilemma, gentlemen, of higher education. Take it down, gentlemen. The institutions of higher learning conquer the automatism of time. You have two choices, gentlemen, in higher education, in all thinking. The old is good, and the young are wrong. And you have the opposite. The young are wrong, right, you see, and the old is bad. Now, we live today in a time where more or less it's taken for granted that the children are right and the parents are wrong. And 100 years ago, of course, was the other way around. The parents were right and the young were wrong. Now, both are asinine statements. They are equally stupid. But how inveterate they are, gentlemen, now let me give you an example. My friend Bartlett here, the professor in biography, once asked one of his students to read up on St. Augustine. St. Augustine, the man whom I have quoted this great sentence, you see, how to rise above mere time. That we can only do this if we have unity in the necessary through all the ages. Liberty in all the dubious things through all the ages, and charity in all times. Now this man, St. Augustine, was born, I think, in 354 AD, and he died in 428 of our era. That's a long time ago. And so the student who was a senior at Dartmouth and expected to be made a senior fellow for his great understanding, wrote the following outburst. Here I am a senior in Dartmouth College. He was a Lord 940. And I already think that the boys of 1917 were very stupid because they were sold down the river and had to go to war in the First World War. And I prize myself far superior. I praise myself far superior to them. And since I think this way with regard to people 23 years my elders, how can I be expected to read what this old man, St. Augustine,
wrote, who died in 428. Now don't laugh, gentlemen, that's by and large your real conviction. You cannot explain why Jesus is of any interest to you. He lived 1900 years ago, and according to your deepest dogma, that was a time of superstition or vanity, and it's long gone. And you cannot explain why you should ever listen to anything he said. It's ununderstandable. You even think of your father that he's obsolete. You are behaved just like the student. So gentlemen, the whole situation in college is really very exciting, because you never are brought up short face to face with your more deepest inner conflict, that you actually believe that later is better. And that everything we try to teach you is obviously in conflict with this, because why should you go to Henry the Fourth? Shakespeare died at least in 1616. Well, these were the days of the religious wars. You have neither religion nor an interest in religious wars. You just go to war for pieces of land or bombs or some such superfluous reason. You don't go to war for a decent reason. They did. They fought for something that was worth it. But you think the opposite. You think they were fools. They think you are knaves, because you only fight for things that aren't worth fighting. But there is this conflict in you, gentlemen. Please, I invite you today to give some consideration to your own dilemma. Do you believe that any man who has lived before 1900 is more stupid than you? In fact, you do believe this. And it is best that you first admit it to yourself and say, yes, instinctively I do. I think he's obsolete. Then you have to dig into this and try to find out in how far you believe. You probably believe it with regard to his choice of an automobile. He probably would make the wrong choice. And in other respects too. But you have to, very, in a giant great hurry, judgment, you have to determine that this isn't true in every respect. That there are certain ways and choices and decisions in which people were much wiser than you are. Much greater. And much more important. And much more useful to consult today than you care to admit in the first place. I would propose to you, gentlemen, if you analyze your own mentality, to admit that you live in a two-chapter mentality. That your first reaction is, that is old, therefore it is obsolete. And that it takes an effort of your imagination to say, well, this is not the whole story. Because I have seen myself too stupidly, although I'm so much younger than my father. So since you know that you are also apt to be stupid, despite the fact that you live in this advanced age and time, there comes this great question, gentlemen, not one of us is ever able to escape this dilemma by instinct. I have to say this is good because it is proven, you see, and tested by time, or it is good because it's the latest invention. These are two great temptations, gentlemen. They are both beneath your human dignity. Throw it off. Gentlemen, nothing is good or evil because it is new or old. If you could find this sentence to be true, gentlemen, you would for the first time become free agents of your choices. Because then you could choose something very old as the latest news, as the best news, you see? And you could reject something despite the fact that it is the latest news, as the latest discovery. As long as you do not this, you are the servant and the slave of time, of the time process. You're just, as Shakespeare calls it, you are the subjects. We are time subjects, he said, that's his prince say. We are time subjects. And therefore, if you look at the Shakespeare's drama, the hell of politics there drags all these people down to death and to the abyss. Only in comedy is Shakespeare out of the time stream. But his time is tragic, because he who is a slave of time, gentlemen, must be ruined by time. All his kings and all his creeds go to pieces. The hell of politics, gentlemen, that is your hell.
the hell of politics. Because in politics, gentlemen, time is the master. And although you don't know it, and you may say you are not interested in elections, with regard to your personal tastes, you are the time slave. I have a neighbor who works 70, 84 hours a week. He has no symptoms. He works 12 hours a day. He, of course, is not organized. He takes care of animals 7 days a week, 12 hours. He lived with his family. It's a scandalous situation. But you have in this country all this contrast. You see, you have here unionized labor where people work 40 hours, and here you have a man who works at the same time 84 hours. Well, he fell out with his children when they grew up, and he had to build himself a little cabin next to his own home. Left the house to his wife and children in there you see a typical development. The younger are always in the right, so the old men were left stranded. So he built himself a little shack next to them. The only thing he has is television. So he has 84 hours of work and television. And that's a symbol of his liberty. To follow the political nonsense via television. That gives him the feeling of being a human being. Now this man is really in hell. Because the only moment off he has is that he is allowed to participate in the nonsense of the times. But that's very typical. I think it's a tremendous story, this man, Mr. Wiley Sr., in my town. Is an outstanding example of the double way in which the human candidacy is burning itself up. He's burning himself up with work, and he's burning himself up, you see, by being a non-entity, by being just a drop in the bucket of the political sensationalism of the time. Because who is he? He pays his celebration people. His good morning, you see, in order to be dragged down to the gutter, with to the hole. That's what comes over television, which isn't worth looking at it anyway. But even by a man who has much time, but let alone by a man who is so tired that when he comes home, you see, the only thing is that he looks at his television and, so to speak, they substitute life for him. That's what they do. That's how he's living. This poor man is oratory. 12 hours a day he is a cock on the wheel with his mates, and the rest he can over keep his eye open. Somebody else lives instead of him and where he lies. There you see, gentlemen, what the superstition that governs you has done to you. You believe in education, but you don't know the first condition of education. Education, gentlemen, is a process by which man rises above his own time. By which the fact that something is of his own time ceases to make law for him. The uneducated person cannot escape the pressures of his own time. He's molded by his own time. You, gentlemen, could, if you still would go to a liberal arts college, rise above your own time. But this has ceased to function, gentlemen, since there were only 30 students in the performance of Henry IV's second part the other day. That is, 3,000 Dartmouth students were not willing to go to 3 performances of Henry IV's second part. Now, if you don't read this liberal arts college, gentlemen, this instrument of higher education, this institution by which people are weaned from this maelstrom of their own time, was based on 2 foundations, the Bible and the classics. And one went to the school in order to read Shakespeare, or that matter, Homer, which was the same, you see, and the Bible. You neither read the Bible nor the classics. You don't go to Shakespeare nor to Chapman. Nothing can help you. You are just a cog on the wheel of your own time. And you may get 10 diplomas from this college. You are not educated. I'm sorry. You can't be educated because you are not. What is educated, gentlemen? to be lifted, educated, and stretched out between the times before you and the times after you, so that you can fill the time gap between the past and the future as an original, a free generation. But you remain inside your own generation, and therefore you can't contribute anything to the order of the time, to the sequence of the time. Like Mr. Wiley, you work perhaps, he works 12 hours and looks at television. You look at television 12 hours, you work 1 hour. That's the only difference. But the two things together don't make a plus. Mr. Wiley, with his 84-hour week of work and 1 hour or 2 hours a day of television, you see, is in no way more a slave of the time than you are. May I ask, when please help me, I must know this. Who went to the movie during the last 4 weeks?
Who went to
a movie during the last 4 weeks? And who went to Henry the Fourth? That's one third. So, the liberal arts college, you see, already has been paralyzed for the last 40 years because the Bible and chapel went out of view. Now you have abolished Shakespeare too. Now there's nothing there. Nothing there. I don't see why it isn't a question of your honor, personal honor, gentlemen, to go to Shakespeare as you go to a football match. I cannot understand why a baseball meeting is more pertinent than a Shakespeare play given by your own comrades. Can you explain this to me? There were 50 boys acting in this play. Every one of you must have known one of them. These gentlemen, how long do you think the Army and the Navy are going to pay the bill for Dartmouth College? Which they do now. You're just a laughing stock of the country. You can become a truck driver without taking an exam here. We need truck drivers, but we don't need people who sit here 4 years and do nothing. I mean, the privileges, gentlemen, of the college are doomed because you don't take advantage of them. If you don't know Shakespeare by heart and the Bible by heart, you have no superiority anymore over the rest of the country. And it is better than not to go to the college. Huey Long, who was, as you know, a very simple-minded man in Louisiana, he had with his political antagonists duels and competitions who could quote Shakespeare and the Bible for a longer time. He won, Huey Long. He won. He knew it better. He was still straight, simple, bigot, but he had worked. He had filled himself with something. You are filled with nothing. Not even hot air. You don't even know what education is, gentlemen. Look at this beautiful word, education. It always means the word syllable E, X, as in existence and ecstasy. It means to get out of something. Where? In the depth of life, of time, that you would be born in 1934 and now here live out to 1954, you are just in this duct, in this narrow channel of impressions, of climate, of environment, of what happens day by day. The way you live, I mean, on your daily breakfast and your daily lunch, I mean, that's a purely physical existence from day to day. This is where you are, in this duct. And you are inducted and educted now in all kinds of things. Inducted also, and we have these introductory courses, which all are trying to prevent you from being educated. Because they try to introduce you into something that is just on the level. As we say, on the level. But gentlemen, education can only be had if you can look back before you were born. And if you can look forward after your death. A person only is a person if at this moment, gentlemen, to you the year 2000 and the year 1900 is as real as the year 1954. That's the minimum. Now, I assure you, once you have conquered 1900, you also have conquered zero. That is, anybody who is educated and who can read Ezra Pound's understanding or Theodore Roosevelt or Old Wister, the Virginian, or the Constitution of the United States of 1776, you see, has reached a level in which all the times begin to shine and to begin to talk to you as your contemporaries. And the same is true of the future. If you can really make the choice of your wife with regard to the final goal of man, the human race, all told, in the year 5000 of our era, then of course every moment of the future is of equal importance to you, and not just tomorrow. Now, where are you, gentlemen? You don't even know what I'm talking about. You have never heard that education means to place your time between the times. That is the meaning of the use of the word the times, gentlemen. It was an attempt, this tame word, the times, in the plural, to make one live one's own time as a limb, as a member of all time. So, you cannot have education, gentlemen, without being lifted out of your context. But don't be afraid. It is not, doesn't mean that you are lifted out of your family, or you are lifted out of your class, or you're lifted out of your country. You are lifted out of your time. Because the time has a blinding or corrupting influence in anybody, rich or poor, noble or human, slave or president. Everyone has to be lifted out of his time. Mr. Eisenhower, just as much as you. So, gentlemen, the outcry in America against the real education has been it's not democratic, because it would set you aside, you see, apart. That's not true. All the good sects in this country, all the religious congregations have managed to get men outside his own mere time. It's the essence of religion to do this. That's why religion without education, education without religion is impossible to have. There is no education unless there is religion, gentlemen. And there is no real religion unless it does more education. And this whole talk today that you can have one or the other is all nonsense. You can have no education, sure, if you would want to stay secular. But don't say that not everybody shows his religion in the way he educates his children. What a man really believes, he proves by the way he educates his children. There's your faith. You can't escape it. You have to do something about it. And that shows, of course, that most parents have no religion, because they allow their children to get a faith they themselves don't have, which is, of course, diabolical, which is ambiguous and is worse than lying, because it's really trying to have two truths at the same time. Have you read Evelyn Waugh's have you read that book? Yeah. Who has read it? Well, this is the hero there, this gentleman who tries to become a Catholic. He is a great type of our time, you see. He doesn't even know what truth is. Remember? Who has read the book? Very important book. The Jesuit to whom this rich man comes and says, oh, I want to become a Catholic. Says, it's a new paganism. I've never met with it. This man is unable to see the difference between truth and untruth. Remember? It's a new sickness. You are all in this sickness. You are all non-committal. Now, gentlemen, let me define then my institution of higher learning once more. In order to make any man participant of an institution of higher learning, he must become immune against the old and the new. It must make no difference whether a thing is old, it might be true just the same, and deserve your dying for it. And it doesn't make a difference whether if the thing is new, it might be good or bad just the same, you see, and again deserve to be defended or to be rejected. That is good and new, or good and old, become separated by education, by higher learning. Which you will learn, gentlemen, in your lives, this is very difficult every day. You become a doctor, gentlemen, and you have learned that a certain procedure is good for your patients, or you think it is. There must come a day, gentlemen, where you, under your own responsibility, look at the new patient and say, in this case, I must not apply what I have learned. If you cannot do this, you have ceased to be a doctor. And yet, the profession will say this man is a heretic. We have always done it this way. You have no right to say this medicine is good because we have always given it. And you cannot say the other way around, this medicine is new, therefore it is good. You have to look at your patient. If more doctors would look at their own patient individually, we would have... No, I won't say what. But this is a tremendous problem today. Most people in the profession think that either if they do the newest thing, it is good. Last year I went in Washington to a family, I stayed with them. There were four little children, they had a cold. You know we have all these tremendous medicines now. But for a simple cold, a child should not get neither calamicin nor oreomycin nor penicillin. But the doctor had just learned that, so he gave these four children all the things he had. And they paid him all the money they had. This is terrible. You see, he had not the nerve to resist the nervousness of this mother of these four little babies who just sniffed. That's all. He was a slave of the latest news. And it ruined these children, their nervous system, because these are not things to tamper with, these new drugs. They're ruined. You can't give them the second time with the same efficiency when it is really necessary. But that's what this country believes in, the latest news in medicine. Takes the appendix out and next day put it in again. Gentlemen, an institution of higher learning must therefore expose a man to opposite opinions on the same subject at the same time, in the same place, in such a way that he can respect the few people who hold these opposite views and cannot feel that one is just obsolete and the other is just modern, you see, but they are of equal validity. And he has to make up his mind by other criteria than that of old or new, of tradition and practice. They are not good enough, these criteria, in an institution of higher learning. I told you, we don't have this, because you have 50 opinions in Dartmouth College on every topic. That's as good as having no opinion. 50 opinions, gentlemen, don't educate you. Two opposite opinions would. So then you would be forced to side with one or the other, or implement your thought in such a way that you can include both. Nobody can have 50 opinions. So the old university is dialectical. And now, in order to round out the picture, this dialectics, that two different sources of the truth were impinging on your mind and asking for your loyalty, for your allegiance, for your taking sides, for your working and fighting for this kind of looking at the thing. This took shape in three great schools, in theology in Paris, in the law in Bologna, and in medicine in Salerno. Of the Salerno Bridgehead, you may have some recollections as a boy when the American troops landed in Salerno, south of Naples. To give you, in a short way, this, the layout of these three schools, you will see that in their setup, in their situation, was implied this polarity, was implied this dialectic in a strange manner. Let me give you slogans. In Paris, there was opposition between the school of the Archbishop and the free schools on the left bank of the River Seine. We talked about this already earlier. That the free schools, the free teachers around Sorbonne and Saint Genevieve on the left bank of the River Seine, under the protection of the king in the Louvre and in competition with the school of the Archbishop here on the Ile Saint-Louis, as it is called, that these schools, together with the school of the Archbishop, offered competition in the doctrines of theology. More than one conviction, you see, could be taught in this University of Paris. And that then, gentlemen, is the difference between a school and a university. In the school of the Archbishop, one opinion for everybody. In the school of Paris as a universe, as a corporation, more than one conviction on the same topic. You never think how close, gentlemen, body and mind lie together. I do not believe in the split of mind and body. Because this was a new principle, it was also incarnated in the form of the school that these professors actually talked against each other in the same building at the same time and attacked each other. As you know, the two greatest teachers of Christendom in the Middle Ages were Saint Bonaventura and Saint Thomas Aquinas. And Saint Thomas Aquinas was a Dominican, and Saint Bonaventura was a Franciscan. Now, to this day, the Dominicans and Franciscans don't hold the same truth, for example, on the Saint Mary, on the cult of Saint Mary. They have different opinions on very serious matters. Now, it is a great story that when St. Thomas once visited St. Bonaventura, he asked for St. Bonaventura's library. And it is well known that St. Thomas Aquinas was very widely read and that he knew his Aristotle by heart and quoted him left and right. Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, being his, you see, authority to debate with, to argue against, or to reconcile St. Paul with. He always has two sources in St. Thomas. If you read his book, it's either the philosophers, or the apostle. Always Paul and Aristotle conversing in the mind of Thomas. Now he comes to St. Bonaventura, or he wasn't a saint at that time, Bonaventura, and says, "Where's your library, Brother Bonaventura?" And Bonaventura just goes to a curtain, as this one here, and pulls it back, and there's a crucifix. The Lord of the crucifix, this is my library. There you have the contrast of two teachers, one basing all his theology on the life of the soul from inner experience and meditation, and the other basing it on libraries of books written in the past in Greek. And that's the difference between Dominicans and Franciscans to this day, by and large. It's the difference between St. Augustine and Plato, or Aristotle for that matter. And in St. Augustine you also have, as in St. Bonaventura, this, which you have in this sentence, in dubious libertas, in necessary unitas, in everything charity. A man who said this, you see, lives it. He knows these things only because he is fully alive to all the problems of life in his own in his own struggles, in his own excitement, whereas Thomas is very apathetic and very indifferent and never mentions his own passions and emotions. He looks into a book and says, well, the apostle says this, the philosopher says this. Well, this isn't the same universe. Here you have two people teaching at the same time, the same students, the same future doctors of theology, and filling them, obviously, with quite two different buckets of mental life, you see. The one, Bonaventura, appealing to these people's inner experience, you see, and the other appealing to a classical text and to its logical understanding. This I only mention as an experience, as the greatest, perhaps the high point of the Parisian university, when between 1257 and 1274, perhaps you will mark these 17 years, when these two people taught at Paris, there was a real university, because both taught in the most different manner and method, and yet they taught the same topic. They taught on the Trinity, they taught on thinking, they taught on progress, on science, on Pope and a church and state, you see, on the sacraments. But their frame of reference was illuminated, one, you see, by the turmoil of a human heart, and the other by the collective tradition of Christendom. Both were respectable authorities. Don't forget this picture. St. Thomas, the learned man, asking for Bonaventura's library and having to put up with the fact that the crucifixus teaches men enough. The School of Bologna is situated in the north of Italy, just north of the Apennine. When you come from Rome to Milan, or from Rome to the Alps, then you cross the Apennines, and there you reach the Adriatic Sea, north of the Apennine. The Apennine swerves, that is the backbone, the spine of the Italian peninsula, and these Apennine mountains go from north of Genoa, that is from the western end of the north of Italy, over to the east. And Bologna is then that city, gentlemen, that is on the Adriatic Sea, just north of the point where the Apennine reaches the Mediterranean, the Adriatic Sea, crossing over from the let me put it roughly, I can't draw, but you will forgive me. This the Apennine Mountain here. This would be Rome, and this would be Florence, and this is Genoa. Then you have here Bologna.
In other words, gentlemen, any emperor of the north, any Roman emperor marching to Rome to be crowned for 600 years from Charlemagne to Charles V, from 800 to 1530, every emperor were willing to receive the crown of the Holy Roman Empire had to pass through Bologna. So in Bologna, gentlemen, the school that was established there was a school that of two different traditions. Just as you have the crucifix, Christ, and Aristotle in Paris, or this cathedral school of the Archbishop of Abelard's ingenious school of free enterprise, wall by wall. So you have in Bologna the imperial lawyers and the papal lawyers who teach canon law and Roman law in Bologna, the two laws. To this day, gentlemen, a man who studies the law has to end up
if he wants to become a doctor of law, as a doctor of two laws. I am Doctor Juris Utri Usque, a doctor of both laws, of canon and of Roman law. That's the official formula. Mr. Morin, I think, our librarian, has the same degree. He is a doctor of law, in fact, I think, given him in Paris. Because to this day, gentlemen, if you become a doctor, you are only a doctor if you can compare the two great systems of law, the law of the state and the law of the church. Canon law is the law of the church. Or you can say, it's the legal order of the universe under the aspect of the church. That's the best translation of canon law. The canons try to describe the legal universe as viewed from the point of view of a Christian, of church. The Roman law aspect is that of the old Caesars, a legal order of property, of contract, of family life, of marriage, of inheritance, looked upon from a legislator who must keep peace among people regardless of their religion, regardless of the highest unity, you see. The state, gentlemen, is always satisfied with the minimum of unanimity. The church is always aiming at the highest degree of unanimity. So, the canon law assumes how should a society be organized under the assumption that all people are on the way of total agreement. And the state must always organize society, you see, on the basis of minimum agreement. That this chair is neither your property nor my property, you see. We must agree whether we are Jews or Catholics or Mohammedans, you see. That's a minimum requirement of secular law, that this is a chair to whom does it belong. It does belong to Dartmouth College, you see. It doesn't belong neither to you nor me. But in a family, there must be some amount of charity. Husband and wife must have certain things in common or there can be no marriage. So there is always some religious faith in any human group. And the legislator must assume that there is a certain peace, you see, a certain imagination, a certain solidarity in the family. To give you a very simple example, how urgent this is, such an understanding is that in every element of law, gentlemen, under which you live, there is one element of canon law and one element of state law. You don't know this. We have no jurisprudence and no science of law because that's lost. This country is barbaric and all law is uniform. It's not true, gentlemen. All law is twofold. It has to comply with the minimum of agreement, you see, because otherwise you would murder each other. But it has to aim at the possibility of a maximum of agreement, otherwise we can't organize society in any progressive manner. Give you an example. In a family, you have to admit that pardon can reconstitute a marriage. If it's a husband and wife quarrel. It's a poor law, it's a pure state law, it's a police law, you see. It's intolerable. It abolishes really the whole institution of marriage. In other cases, in Massachusetts, when a husband has a poor wife, he has to support her. But the damn suffragists in that state of Massachusetts have managed to put through the rule that a woman who has property has not to support her. Now, I know a man who was a minister here in the neighborhood in Lebanon. And his wife, who was wealthy, said to him, "Oh, I'm fed up with Lebanon. I don't blame her." And she moved away. And she being a person of means, she became selectman in a little town in Massachusetts. And one day she was fed up with him. He was then 72. And the child that had been the link between them had grown up and got a free marriage. And she said, "I'm no longer going to support you." So she had, you see, determined his whole career.
that he was no longer a minister, he had no pension coming to him. He had ceased to be a minister at 66 or 56 or so, so that the pension funds he just hadn't come.
Well, to make a long story short, he finally committed suicide, or tried to commit suicide,
and he's now in the charge of a friend of mine in this town. His wife to this day doesn't pay a cent. That's a devilish law, I might assume. It's a pagan law, you see. This side of Christianity, which the suffragists have put through there, and you see how they relax into paganism can have any minute in the law. Because it is immoral that a wife can get out of her duty to support her husband. It's shameless. Nobody cried wolf. We live in a nice society in which you see the after 400 years of secular law, it is possible for the legislature to put through such a draconic measure that this man is ruined for life. He's a LSA, he's closed by collecting this friend of mine collects old clothes for him, and she tries to scratch together. She's herself an old lady and has earned hard, in a hard life the little bit she has. Because his wife just decided to do it.
The former congregation
does a little bit here in Lebanon, and that's why it's here around here, and that's why I know his story. That's a terrible story. And it shows you what a pure imperial law, a pure secular law can do. How what it exists. Can you see that? So, gentlemen, the Bolognese people, by basking or by balancing every student of law between two extremes, the law of the church and the law of the state, taught these people that at any one case, there had to be some creative and imaginative solution. For example, gentlemen, peasants, farmers, always want to have the properties stay together. So they want to marry their first cousin or their neighbor's daughter because that is good for the property. That's an old problem of Europe, of China, of all countries of pure pagan agriculture. You see, that it's wise to keep the property together. And that's what influences the marriage. Now the whole of the Catholic Church, as you may know from the famous novel from Manzoni, the Promessi Sposi, have you ever heard of that? Who has heard of the Manzoni's novel? No? Not one? Well, it used to be one of the great stories of the world literature. I think it still is. But the world literature just has no luck with you. The church, down to the days of Henry VIII of England, as you know, lived by the maxim that a woman could not be forced to marry a man without her free consent. And the church, you may say, from 800 to 1500 did just nothing but that. To inculcate that the personal bond of marriage was the free act of a soul and not of a member of a family. But if you read the old epics, you also know that children were betrothed in the cradle. You read that a prince and a princess were put together so that the countries wouldn't go to war against each other. That is, gentlemen, marriage is always politics. And it should be considered as very serious when a Roosevelt marries a Dupont. That's politics. You can't help it. It's good politics. That's how the way makes peace. Marriage is nothing between you and a girl of another sex, the person of the other sex. It's an attempt to have peacemaking in the largest possible sense. If you don't understand this, you don't know that you have to, it takes you 50 years to marry what you get when you marry a woman with real background. If you just marry her beautiful looks, they will not be there after 5 years. Then you buy, why don't you buy lipstick straight away? We'd have to get the girl. Gentlemen, when you are married 30 and 40 years, you are married, then you haven't married for the looks, but you have married for that which is behind the looks. And that is a long story. That's the whole story of our family, of the religion of the family, of the background of the family, of the character, features of the character of the family. That's one branch of mankind, otherwise hidden from you, inaccessible to you.
And that's why marriage is so interesting.
Now, this is the doctrine of the medieval church in the canon law of Bologna. Gentlemen, there had to be a compromise. The Bolognese school said, with regard to property, the emperor and the communities and the burgomasters of the cities and the princes can make law. How the property of a girl that marries shall be handled by the husband or by her own family. But as to the personal decision, who can marry whom, that's under strictly papal law, under strictly ecclesiastical law, under canon law. So we get here, gentlemen, a problem between canon law and imperial law, which today still is undecided, is in the same way in abeyance. Who can marry whom is to be decided by one source of law. What are the material consequences when one marries whom must be decided by quite another consideration and source of law. To give you a very practical example today, when people marry today, the marriage can either be favored by the tax laws or it can be ruined. If you have 5 children, you get no exemption, and you earn the same wage as without the 5 children, you see. There's a premium on remaining a bachelor. And the society, the secular order of society, in this sense then, favors no children. It's a decision the society takes. As you know, it has been a headache for all legislators. What shall we do with a child's wage? With people who have many children, you see. Shall they be get exemptions or shall their wages be increased by the employer? It has been decided in various countries in a different manner. I'm not going to tell you what the right decision is. I'm only trying to show you that there is a tremendous decision to be made as to the material consequences of a family. The material side. Now take the other side. Who decides who can marry whom? In this country, you are allowed as an 11-year-old child can be married to a 76-year-old man. You saw this asinine story of this Anglo-Saxon gentleman who married an 80-year-old lady. He was 68, and she died, unfortunately, 11 years later. Is this a marriage? Isn't that a caricature of a marriage? Is it permissible to say that these people should marry? I think it's blasphemous. It's terrible. But that's a custom in this country. Because when people are good friends, at 87 in Vermont and at 89 in New Hampshire, they marry. You must should rise in an uproar of disgust of this miscarriage of justice, gentlemen. Marriage is no longer marriage when it can be used for such ridiculous and obscene purposes. It's obscene when the 90-year-old person and the 87-year-old housekeeper get married. It's obscene. But you are no rewarding you because you have no relation to marriage. You don't know what a wonderful revelation it is that God and society and human speech and the physical urges of your body, that they all should be in harmony. That's the greatness of marriage. That what is done by the body is also implemented by the soul and spoken by the mouth. So if only the mouth speaks empty words, then we are married. No, then that's nonsense. In the old canon law, that's not a marriage. A marriage that cannot be physically contrived and consummated according to a Roman Catholic canon is under annulment. There's no marriage. Our Protestant willful Renaissance mentality has said, we can will anything. Gentlemen, no man can will to be a woman and no woman can man to be a man, and a man who is neither, a person who is neither a man nor a woman cannot say that he is a man or a woman, you see. Impotency and loss has no cause in the cause of justice. But in this country, impotency wins. Look at all these Hollywood stars with their adopted children. So
So, gentlemen, we are full in a world which has lost the distinction between canon law and imperial law. You don't even know that there is a higher authority which must explain you what marriage is. Marriage is the unity of the moment and eternity in your existence, gentlemen. Here we are, flesh, mortal, living 70 years at best on this earth, with our physical urges passing, our passion, our season. And yet the spring of your spring fever, gentlemen, of your passion, can be exhorted. Look at this figure of education once more. So that it means something in the rhythm of the generation. That which in itself is just of the moment, and not worth consideration at all, can be exhorted by your meeting the right partner and speaking the right word through the key into eternity, because mankind only lives by generations and by marriage. And so the same candid passion of the moment, in the moment in which the right word is spoken between the two, becomes the groundwork of the whole order of society for the rest of the world. All Jews come only from one couple, Abraham and Sarah. Mankind doesn't go except by generation. It doesn't exist. So this is the very thing, gentlemen, about the law, which is very little under consideration at this moment. I think it's a very great example of the profundity of the process of higher learning, of higher education, gentlemen, in a good country, as we should discuss who can marry whom. Very serious. If you think that the modern man discusses incest all the time, the time is very near where people no longer will understand why a mother shouldn't marry her son. We are told they all want to. No, well, that's the story of psychoanalysis. You are surprised, sir. Have you never heard of psychoanalysis? Psychoanalysis says that every mother wants to be to the son. It's ridiculous, but they say so. Terrible. But if you go on like that and read so enough Thomas Mann long enough, then you begin to believe it. And then you are faced with the question, who can marry whom? Why isn't it impossible that mother marries a son? Well, you and I feel still that it is impossible. But obviously the law has in every generation to teach again why it is impossible. Otherwise, at one time, you see, the handicap will disappear. People will just flinch. And they do in India, I mean, where these children are put together. There's neither sister nor brother, they have nothing. They are just, you see, below parity. India is ruled, as you know, by the early marriage system, where children are there and they get married. They have no kind of law fighting, you see, the interests of the family business. India is, as every Hindu will tell you, ruined by its lack of fight, by its lack of higher education with regard to the law. They have no war on them. They have no constant fight between the material interests of the family group, you see, and the sensuous interests of these children, and the higher aims of a society that must live by perpetrating real love. I can't go over, I only wanted to hint, because I have to be so short today, that in the law, there is as much excitement as in the discussion of St. Bonaventura and St. Thomas. The schools of theology, gentlemen, aren't any more interesting than the schools of law. But in Bologna, you became a doctor of both laws. And the great compromises on which our modern legislation still is based were reached there. For example, the material interests of marriage are under the jurisdiction of the state. The personal interests of the marriage partners are under the jurisdiction of the church. By and large, it is still our law. because we still understand, for the court has to acknowledge to the forgiveness, you see, wipes out his right of internet. That's a religious rule. It has nothing to do with secular law.
Well, sir, what about the state which recognizes divorce and the church which doesn't? The Catholic Church.
Well, this is, of course, very profound. It is as simple as you make it. There are two things I would like to use with you. I would like to go into this for many hours. It would be a whole course, so to speak. Gentlemen, there are two things. The church, the Roman church has forgiven divorce, but it has none. So that, for example, physically not consummated marriage, you see, is no marriage. That makes, I mean, for some difference. In a Protestant marriage, that would be not valid. And in itself, a nullity marriage. They would still say these people have been married, now they can be divorced. The Catholic Church have had in many of these cases, but the marriage never took place. And there are more such cases than you think of where in this special case these people can't get together, you see, because of incompetence. These people may be perfectly quoted, as you know, with other problems. But the thing to do the magic of love doesn't work. And so that I know two cases of very famous men in the last generation who married in a brotherly spirit, so to speak, from very generous and heroic reasons, you see, never could get married to these women, where there was no doubt that they were perfectly important men. In fact, in case the Catholic Church would insist that they should not treat themselves, you see, consider that they were married. One person reported these men were Protestants, and thought they had to say it. So you see, sometimes it works the other way around, that the Roman Church would make, you see, more readily for separation than the secular or the Protestant. The other thing is I would like to mention is we are faced, of course, with the fact that many people don't know what they're doing when they're married. And I think the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church are faced with your problem. It's your problem too, gentlemen. I'm quite serious about it. And many of you think they do something what they don't do. To sleep with a woman is not to get married. And this is the twilight in which we move. Formally, gentlemen, only 60% of the people physically fit and mature were able to marry for economic reasons, unknown to them. The church, the Roman Catholic Church in the Middle Ages could afford marriage because innumerable people could never marry for economic reasons, because you could only marry to have your own household, you see, and your own livelihood. Service could marry. Today we have the opposite. 10 or 20% of the people now. In 760. So everything is in reverse. Many people marry who are really just children. They are ashamed to go into a brothel so they get married. That's the good reason. You see, puberty is no reason for getting for marriage. The same comes to do with puberty and marriage. Puberty is selective, marriage is selective, puberty is unselective. And so I do feel that when you have put the finger on the very sore spot of our civilization, you see, the church has never been faced for the first 1800 years of our existence with the fact that more people can use the term marriage than are actually able to understand what they're doing in getting married. They can marry out of season early on, at 17, at 16, at 18, you see, all these things. And so, I've been in this prayer with my Catholic brothers, priests. They have written together on this marriage problem. It's entirely a new situation for the church. Because as long as you have slavery, as long as you have economic inhibitions, as long as you have clerks and guilds and all kinds of professional, you see, restrictions, an indentured servant, for example, could not marry this guy. Have you ever read Paradise by Esther Ford?
where that is present in terms of the invention of Massachusetts, the fact that the inventor of Germany just couldn't have it. He couldn't. Because he had no economic independence. So, the church was had developed a whole policy, so to speak, in a world full of restrictions for them. And not in suits today, where people call marriage, you see, what we shouldn't, what we, what Father has said is not marriage. Neither one, not once. And so it's odious to call these things, you see, marriage and the title to determine them by the standards of the church. I mean, this is only the beginning of the discussion, and I only want to show you there are these two points that the church, by inertia, has tried to keep people aware that the whole thing, body and soul, must enter into for Israel. And on the other hand, that the church has never been prepared to think that anybody could just go within 24 hours and get married. That's enter.
I'm sorry, I'm just joking.